listener production.
A warning. This episode contains references to infant loss and violence against children. If this content affects you, help is always available at Red Nose Grief and Loss. Dial their 24/7 support line on 1300 308 307 or call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Welcome to Crime Insiders Forensics. For those joining us for the first time, my name's Catherine Fox. I'm a former GP, crime author, and screenwriter. I'm enthralled by forensics and have spent thousands of hours researching for books and screenplays. So I thought, why not turn my research into a podcast? Every week, you'll be joining me in discovering how forensic science is helping solve high-profile crimes in Australia and around the world. This week, how forensics and the Australian legal system failed Kathleen Folbig.
The jury heard the doctor saying yes to the prosecutor asking them, really, doctor, you really think that these babies were killed, don't you?
Professor Stephen Cordner is one of Australia's most respected forensic experts. In 2021, Stephen was one of 90 eminent scientists who signed a groundbreaking petition calling for the immediate pardon and release of Kathleen Folbig.
There's a much greater risk of wrong conviction in our criminal justice system than people realise.
In 2003, Kathleen was convicted of killing her four infant children. However, based on scientific advances in the years following her imprisonment, these experts believe Kathleen had been wrongfully convicted. We'll understand what the evidence was and how it changed things for Kathleen. But first, we'll go back more than 20 years to where it all began.
Kathleen had four children over a 10-year period with her husband, and each of them died suddenly and unexpectedly, with Caleb, who died at 19 days, Patrick, who died at 8.5 months, Sarah, who died at 10 months, and Laura, who died at 19 months. Essentially, Caleb was 19 days, but the circumstances of his death were SIDS-like. He was simply found dead in his cot. The paediatrician who'd been looking after him had mentioned that maybe he had a bit of a floppy larynx, but that's sort of not something that concerned anybody, either then or even in retrospect, as a significant issue. 19 days is technically before the period when the term sudden infant death syndrome is comfortably used, but essentially that was the sort of death that Caleb had, and indeed that was what the pathologist who did the autopsy at the time concluded. Patrick was the second death, and about 4 months in after he was born, he had some sort of event where his mother came upon him. He was taken to hospital and was having seizures. As a result of these seizures, he had brain damage. I should be a little bit careful about saying as a result of the seizures he had brain damage, because at the trial, the brain damage was said to be due to smothering. They didn't really discover a diagnosis for why he had brain damage. At the time, there was serious consideration given to herpes simplex encephalitis, but that diagnosis was never made. And they certainly investigated Patrick for everything they could, but they couldn't come up with a diagnosis. 4 months after that diagnosis, and he'd had some pretty serious seizures, multiple admissions to hospitals, he was found dead or very close to death in his cot by his mother. and ambulance called again, but he was dead. There was an autopsy, and the cause of death was basically given as epileptic seizures, but really the cause of death was whatever caused the event 4 months previously. But at the trial, this death was also one that was laid against Kathleen, and she was eventually convicted of Patrick's death as well as convicted of causing grievous bodily harm 4 months previously. Then Sarah, she died at about 10 months, found dead or very close to death in her cot by her mother. The fact that Kathleen found all the children was held against her in the trial. Then Laura, 19 months, everything going swimmingly. She had a cold a couple of days before she died. There's a video of her at a party, and she went for sort of an afternoon nap and was found dead or dying at that time. She wasn't actually pronounced dead until after she got to hospital, I think. At the autopsy, like all of the children, there were no signs of injury, with the exception of Sarah, who had two tiny little scratches on her lower lip, which all along the way, everyone has agreed, is really of no significance and could well have been done by Sarah herself, if not having occurred during resuscitation. So none of the babies had any injuries. Laura had no injuries. Laura had teeth, which is relevant in the sense that if you're going to say that Laura, as the others, were alleged to have died, if Laura was smothered, then pressure on the mouth might well be expected to have left some marks on the inside of the lips, as in her case she had upper and lower teeth. So the pathologist in that case, in Laura's case, found that her heart had infection, inflammation, called myocarditis, but notwithstanding that, he felt that he couldn't conclude why Laura died, particularly in view of the fact that there had been three previous deaths in the family. And one thing led to another. Police involved. Kathleen kept diaries. The police got to hear about the diaries. The husband told police about the diaries. He was very concerned, and he handed them over to police. The diaries formed a very significant part of the prosecution case because the prosecution said that some of the entries were tantamount to confessions. So any sort of laxity, if you like, in the medical evidence was more than made up for, so the prosecution thought, by Kathleen's entries in the diaries.
Was there any evidence that Kathleen's behaviour altered after the loss of her first child in terms of parenting?
In general terms, the evidence that was available at the trial was that Kathleen was a good mother, that, yes, there were periods when she would get fed up or had too much of the children or needed to hand the child over to her husband. But generally speaking, the people who observed her behaviour with the children provided no evidence that there was abuse of any sort of the children.
Well, one thing that did stand out for me was that with Laura, the 19-month-old, she was too old to be diagnosed with SIDS, but she had symptoms of a viral infection. And then myocarditis, inflammation of the heart, can be caused by viruses, and it can cause arrhythmias, which are abnormal heart rhythms, which can cause death. And to me, that just screamed, how could somebody dismiss that as a potential natural cause of death, to the point that they had no reasonable doubt that this child had been murdered? that just stood out to me as horrifying, because as I understand SIDS, it's a diagnosis of exclusion more than a diagnosis of a cause of death. And then the fourth child, Laura, had a possible cause of death with myocarditis, but that was glossed over. And that was when the pathologist notified the police about the three prior children and this one being suspicious. To me, that was odd. Reading straight away, it was extremely odd.
And looking backwards, it looks even odder. But at the time, the perspective was very different. There was a stream of thought, a stream of understanding, I think people thought back then, which is encapsulated by Meadows, what's called Meadows' Law. The Americans call it DeMeo's Law, which essentially goes like this, that one, sudden infant death in a family is a tragedy, two is suspicious, and three is murder until proven otherwise. And that's exactly how it played out in Kathleen Folbig's case. That's the type of thinking that permeated, as the inquirer in the second inquiry found. He found that this sort of thinking that I've just mentioned, Meadows' Law, permeated the whole prosecution. And, of course, the right way to think about these is, well, we didn't know what happened to Caleb. Actually, there was some seizures, but we didn't really know what happened to Patrick. We didn't really know what happened to Sarah. And as you've just said, actually, there's quite a good explanation for Laura's death, the myocarditis. The right way to think of those deaths was, well, actually, for the first three, we don't really know. And for Laura, we probably or possibly do know. That would have been the right way to think about it. So that sort of thinking that multiple SIDS means murder, despite the presence of myocarditis in Laura, added to that was the thought that you could smother a baby and leave no signs. Now, a very important thing for me was that there were no signs, no injuries at all. For example, in Laura. Laura had teeth. She's 19 months old. I think most parents would agree that a 19-month-old is not a totally weak person. They've actually got some strength, and you can't, you know, if you could imagine, perfectly reasonable to suppose that a 19-month-old would struggle if they were being smothered.
We've seen them have tantrums in supermarkets. We've seen 19-month-olds hit, lash out.
And yet there was nothing, not a skerrick, nothing. So I reckoned and wrote that that was evidence against smothering in Laura's case, that there was nothing.
One of the things that I think you've looked at in retrospect, the definition of asphyxia, and that this is a word used in strangulations, in smotherings, and it's used in popular culture. Asphyxia, when you see it on CSI, Law and Order, any of those shows, means murder. And there was something that this sort of all culminated at the International Association of Forensic Science conference in November in Sydney, the giant one. And I was in the room. And what absolutely shocked me was that everybody there said that there was no universal definition of the word asphyxia. And there was a Canadian pathologist there who said, oh yeah, cause of death for somebody was swallowing a gerbil and it compressed the airway, and that was asphyxia. That wasn't murder, that wasn't strangulation, that was self-inflicted. So that started a sort of a conversation within the conversations that were going around in the room. What did you find when you looked at the language used in Kathleen Folbig's trial with reference to the word asphyxia?
Asphyxia is a shocker of a word and should be ditched. So we should try and do our work as forensic doctors without using the word asphyxia. That's because I think, and there's evidence for, if you look at the Urban Dictionary, which has understandings that people in the street have of words, talks about asphyxia as you just did, sort of violent, strangling, usually associated with death, accompanied at the time we looked at the Urban Dictionary by an image of a man throttling a woman in a very violent way. So when the word asphyxia was used at the trial, and it was used some hundreds of times in the six-week trial, so the jury was hearing the word day in, day out. And if they're representative of people in the street, 300 times they would have been hearing something akin to throttling, even if the people using the word tried to say what they meant by it. The lawyers would have been somewhere in between the expert and the jury in their understanding. The prosecutor had a particular understanding of asphyxia. He thought the doctors were saying that they could tell that from their examination that something had interfered with the breathing of the children. That's what he said in his opening. He said the doctors will tell you that there has been external interference with the process of the baby's breathing. Now, he didn't close with that because by that time he'd sort of understood a bit further. But he had a misunderstanding of what it was the doctors were going to say. And then if you asked the doctors what they thought they were saying when they used the word asphyxia, they'd say, oh, all we mean is that, you know, there's low oxygen in the blood. So it meant nothing really in that context. When you're using it like that, asphyxia as, you know, equaling low oxygen, it really is not a very helpful word for understanding why someone has died. If you add to that a very common question that the prosecutor asked of all the doctors, and there were 19 doctors who gave evidence at the trial, huge number of doctors, and many of them were asked for each of the four babies, so doctor, were the findings consistent with the child, Caleb, Patrick, Sarah, Laura, having, quote, an acute catastrophic asphyxiating event? Okay, that was the phrase that the prosecutor used, and I can only imagine that if I was in the jury box hearing the prosecutor say, you know, and were the findings consistent with an acute catastrophic asphyxiating event, the jurymen and all the doctors saying yes to all of the babies and thinking in terms of a low oxygen thing, the jury wouldn't have been human if they didn't hear, oh, you know, murder. They heard, I reckon the jury heard the doctors saying yes to the prosecutor asking them, really, doctor, you really think that these babies were killed, don't you?
To me, that's akin to saying, you know, everybody dies of a cardiac arrest, but not everyone is murdered who dies of a cardiac arrest.
Right.
Every single death is eventually caused by a cardiac arrest.
And you could equally say that every single death is a catastrophic asphyxiating event.
Correct. I mean, this is where I wonder, it's almost like a game then that lawyers are doing. But this was Kathleen Folbig's life. She's already traumatised from the deaths of four children. which is inconceivable for most of us. There's not even a word in the English language for a parent who's lost a child. We have words for orphans, we have words for widows and widower, but we don't have a word to capture this kind of grief. So try to imagine Kathleen grieving and then being convicted and then constantly hearing. It must have been the ultimate gaslight for her to be hearing that she was the cause of these catastrophic lack of oxygen events and then being convicted. How long was it before the genetic testing was applied to Kathleen's children? And was it done specifically for that, or did it just happen that the genetic testing evolved and then someone thought to apply it back to the Folbig case?
There was no genetic testing at all done in any of the deaths. At the time, there was no genetic testing done in preparation for the trial. When I wrote my report, I'm glad to say that 25% of the report was about possible, you know, about discussing the potential role for genetics, although I did not discover or mention myself the Kalmodulin gene, so I missed that. Then a fabulous person in Professor Carola Vinuesa, then a professor at ANU, who's a Spanish doctor, who had trained further in England and come out to ANU. She's now a fellow of the Royal Society, so she is one of the world's top scientists. She was prevailed upon by supporters and representatives of Kathleen to code her genome. And this work was ongoing at the time of the first inquiry. And she believed that, and correctly, as it turns out, that she had discovered something of significance back at the first inquiry. Another problem for the first inquiry was that it dismissed evidence and favoured another group of geneticists who came to a different conclusion. The genetic work continued after the first inquiry and further elucidated and evaluated the discoveries and were able to conclude that with a very high degree of likelihood, the genetic abnormalities found in Sarah and Laura were pathogenic, that is, that they would have caused pathological clinical problems for Laura and Sarah. So, and that, of course, won the day. It convinced the 90 best Australian scientists to sign the petition and ended up convincing the Commission of Inquiry that there was sufficient doubt. So that all comes back to Carola Vinuesa, who had to withstand some pretty serious assaults on her professionalism along the way. She's a hero in this story.
Was Kathleen Folbig informed about this all the way, or was this going on some of it behind the scenes?
All the way along, she's had very good legal representatives. Pro bono, it has to be said, pro bono. Not enough credit goes to, and over the journey I've seen a lot of lawyers who do work for clients for nothing. I don't think the lawyers for Kathleen have been paid anything at all along the journey. The state has been very parsimonious about doing anything to help Kathleen along the way. So lawyers have done a huge amount for her, but also friends. So she's had a very loyal group of friends. The leader of whom is Tracy Chapman, who's stood by her and pushed and pushed and poked and prodded and pen to paper and talking to groups and people, that's without that, much of the progress that was made simply wouldn't happen. It's a very common theme in people who eventually prevail in having their wrong conviction overturned that they have a very strong support group. And of course, for very many people in prison, getting a strong support group is a seriously difficult thing to do.
I think one thing that we should mention too is that she did exhaust all her avenues for appeal, but that was prior to the genetic testing being available.
She was wrongly convicted, therefore she was wrongly imprisoned. It's going to be really interesting to see how the government in New South Wales deals with compensation. Compensation is not available by right in New South Wales. It's a discretion, and it's a discretion for the Attorney General to exercise on behalf of the government. So if the government looks to another case, the one in the ACT, where the man wrongly convicted for the murder of the assistant commissioner down there, the government originally offered him $2 million. He was able to appeal and say that the amount offered to him by discretion simply didn't meet a legal standard that they had in the ACT. Well, in New South Wales, that's just not possible. Kathleen Folbig will get whatever the Attorney General decides, and that will not be able to be, as I understand it, appealed or argued with.
Stephen, what would you like to see happen so that a case like Kathleen Folbig's doesn't happen again?
That's a huge question. I mean, first thing I'd just reiterate is that Australia does need a Criminal Cases Review Commission, and that would allow people in Kathleen's position, at least after their conviction, to have another way of getting their case looked at. And if you're just imagine being wrongly convicted and sitting in jail, your options are almost nil in terms of establishing your wrong conviction. But your question really was how to prevent Kathleen's experience happening in the first place. And I'm not sure, Kathy, that the legal system, the criminal justice system, and I've been a servant of the criminal justice system for 40 years. I don't think the criminal justice system is completely broken or, you know, needs to be thrown out and start from the beginning again. I think Australia's got a reasonable criminal justice system, but it is definitely not perfect. And I don't see the criminal justice system operating as a system. I see it operating as a whole lot of silos. And there's some sort of structural justification to that. I mean, judges would say, well, we have to be a silo. We've got to be separate. And so I sort of, you know, obviously see and understand that. But systems, such as many people understand them, making a motor car involves a system that self-corrects. It has a whole subsystem of identifying errors or near mistakes that feed back into the system so that it can correct, so that those mistakes or near misses don't happen again. And there's a whole science, really. There's a whole literature about how that works. I don't see that happening in the criminal justice system. When things go wrong, who's the person who's supposed to inquire into that, discover what went wrong, engage the relevant stakeholders, and ensure that the remedies are put in place? There's nobody, as far as I can see, whose role is to do that. And until there is such a thing, these things are going to happen again. If you go into a public hospital, everybody's sort of got a little bit of an understanding that going into a hospital, you know, is where you need to go to have your illness or injury fixed. But they know that things can go wrong in hospitals. Every self-respecting hospital in Australia has a quality system which is geared to making sure that if something goes wrong or nearly goes wrong, that they fix it quickly, because that's going to come back and bite them. I don't see the same thing in the justice system. I think there's a much greater risk of wrong conviction in our criminal justice system than people realise.
Stephen, this has been really informative and disturbing at the same time as to how such a miscarriage of justice can take place in Australia. But I'm very glad that finally Kathleen Folbig is free, and that science and forensic science have definitely helped her in proving her innocence, for want of a better description. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for asking me.
Crime Insiders Forensics is a listener original production. It's hosted by me, Catherine Fox, and is produced by Ed Gooden. Sound design and imaging is by Link Kelly.